Oh, let's be a 17. And where was the school?
In the convents. There was one school in a convent which was situated along the main road. As you travel inwards, it was on the left-hand side, I recall. That's for, and I think the brothers might have had a school for the boys, which is on the right-hand side. I think they did. And Mukim Five also had their own schools in their convents. The teachers were the nuns and the brothers. They might have drawn some talent from the settlers themselves. I don't know. But outside of the schools run by the nuns, there were none others. And these schools were open to even the non-Catholics. Protestants, as far as I recall, did not have a school of their own. There weren't very many, anyway. You were talking about the administration of a Bahau settlement, and that Bahau was split into two Mukims, Mukim 5 for the Chinese and Mukim 6 for the Eurasians, the Protestants, and the neutrals. There were a few Chinese living in Mukim 6, Chinese Catholics, but the majority of them were placed in Mukim 5. Why the separation? Why Mukim 5? Why Mukim 6? I mean, it is purely geographical. It is purely availability of land. And why separation? Because, of course, because of the communal attitudes prevailing. The Chinese want to stay with Chinese, Eurasians want to stay with Chinese, and over the Eurasians, and they didn't want to mix. I mean, they were not used to it, let's put it that way. They were not used to it. They were used only to mixing with people of their own ethnic groups. Now,
the facilities given to the Mukim 5 and 6, were they all the same?
Yes, they were the same. I think the main administrators were situated in Mukim 6. They were the overall, they were in charge overall. But I think Mukim 5 did have some degree of autonomy. They did have a subcommittee which looked after their own affairs. Of course, you know, when you, in comparing the progress made by the two areas, agriculture-wise, it is clear that Mukim 5 was very much in advance to Mukim 6. Much more was done in Mukim 5 as compared with what was done in Mukim 6. Living conditions weren't better. Soil conditions, I don't think, were better, but it's just that the Chinese are known to be industrious, and the Eurasians are known not to be industrious. So this is the difference. Qualify that, majority of them. I claim myself to have been very industrious. I claim myself to have done a lot in my own area, and I claim that I produced quite a surplus of food. And the funny thing is, I was not able to get rid of the surplus. There were no facilities in, not proper facilities. They did not provide proper facilities for the settlers to sell their surplus. their products. That was ironical, it was.
But could you bring your surplus to Bahau town?
And
or
sell
to
it?
The Malay kampongs no. around the area?
You know, I think I... Was that you I mentioned it to, or was it to Ms. Irene Ho? I don't know. You see, we were just purely amateur farmers. And for the first 3 miles along the side, and all the way inside, all around Bahau town itself, there were these professional farmers who were turning out vegetables, poultry, doing it the proper way. You know, and they were the ones who had plenty of good stuff to sell. We just didn't have. We had just moth-eaten bits of sweet potato to sell. But what we did have, what I had plenty to get rid of, which I couldn't, were bananas. Bananas somehow liked the soil and grew very, very profusely, luxuriantly, and the bananas were so sizable that even till today I've never seen bananas that size, that big, that sweet, that succulent. But I couldn't eat, we couldn't eat our bananas, and so much of it, we gave bananas to neighbors, I gave to the convent, and there again it was a big problem conveying it along our paths, carrying it along our paths to give them away.
How about selling your surplus to shops in the town, in the center of the settlement? Were there shops or restaurants?
No, yes, like there were, there were. But I don't think they were interested. Probably they had their own to sell. There were little, yes, that's another facility I haven't touched on. There were shops. There were three shops set up in Mukim 6, selling provisions. You call the provisions if you like. All along the main road, as you travel along the road inland, inwards, the first one on the left was a shop run by a man called Harry Trollope. He and his wife and children managed that shop, and they would sell meat, which they would get from Bahau town. They would sell sagu. They would sell sweet potato, anything that you need, one needed. Then further down on the right was another shop that was run by Hilary Don, along the same lines. And further down on the right was another shop run by the most industrious of them all, a man called Herman Hooden. Herman Hooden was a Portuguese Eurasian, hardworking, industrious, and he had a little restaurant. He used to turn out things to eat. Coffee, he used to sell coffee and things like that. Yes, of course. I mean, you know, our tastes that time, we would accept anything. It's our local coffee with a lot of chicory. And we could buy things like gula melaka. If we couldn't get crystal white sugar, we could get gula melaka. And we make cakes out of these to sell cakes. And he was the cheapest as far as meat was concerned. He didn't. He was happy with a small profit. He was a man who would come to our
parties in my house and sell cakes and produce toddy, produce Nambuku wine for us to get drunk on. Those were the shops. And there were also some ladies who would make some cakes and send their little boys out selling them out of sago, bananas, fried bananas, and so on. Pisang goreng.
Any shop selling clothes or, say, kitchen utensils or things like a barber shop?
Yes, no. That's an interesting thing. Now, as far as kitchen utensils are concerned, I think we were able to pick up a few odd things from these shops. But for, in the main, we would take a trip to Bahao, where the selection was greater. I mean, very few of us would buy utensils of this nature, because we would have brought our own to last us for many months. And there were other settlers who would try to raise money and sell little plates, pottery. I remember I bought a set of cups from a man called Lionel Cuff. And these were nice, gay little cups for my son with figures. And I remember buying those. Barbers, there was a barber shop run by Chinese, and later it was revealed that the chief barber was a was an officer of the MPAJA. He was one of those who was planted in the settlement. Nobody knew about his activities, his connection with MPAJA. Nobody. He was such an affable man, and he was my favorite barber. And he was the man who conducted the hearing, as I talked of, and I shall talk of later. There were also one or two settlers who cut hair. One of them was Mr. Cordero, who was the husband of the midwife I told you about. Let me carry on talking as I can't get things in my head. I may be ambling, or I may be, you know, diverting from the theme. But talking about Mrs. Cordero brings this to my mind. We discovered in the early part of 1945 that my wife was pregnant. Now this worried us a bit, because many women had been pregnant there. Well, there were lots of pregnancies there. And without exception, all these pregnancies either were terminated as miscarriages, or if they went full term, the babies were stillborn. There was not a successful birth in Bahao because of the poor state of health of the mothers, and because of the fact that they were all suffering from malaria. So we were very worried, because my wife didn't have a very good history of gynecological history, obstetrical history, because the first time she got pregnant, she had an abortion. This is when we were still in Shonanto, and she was looked after by the late President Shears, who was then a very good friend of ours, Benny Shears. Second time she got pregnant, she nearly lost the baby, but Michael was born, also delivered by Benny Shears at Shawbury Inn. Now, for the third time, she was pregnant, and we were very worried about this. But in the first trimester, nothing happened. Nothing happened, actually. She was bore her pregnancy very well. And when calculating the dates, of course, she was looked after by her father, gave her necessary vitamin injections or what have you, I don't know. We decided to spend every night at the hospital. So my wife and I would, just before sunset, we would walk all that way down to the hospital where we were provided with a couple of beds. And then the day came. My wife got the pains, and it was also in the evening. So we raced down to the hospital, and but no signs of the baby. It was getting dark, and Mrs. Cordero, the midwife, required light, bright light. So I raced down to the nearby neutrals. I went to one of the houses. I said, could you please lend me a carbide light, which is a very bright light. And so I got this carbide light, got it going, and by the time I reached the hospital, the baby had been born, though barely. He had a cord around the neck, but Mrs. Cordero was a very capable, very efficient midwife, and Rodney survived. And he was just the second successful birth in Bahá'í. The first one having been born just a couple of weeks before. A friend had a baby girl, and that was the first successful birth ever in Bahá'í. So that gave us a little bit of hope. And then Rodney was born. And he was born on the 19th of July, 1945. Just a few months, 2 months before the...
Less than a month.
July. Oh, that's right, less than a month. Now, but don't forget the surrender of Singapore, the Japanese surrender, was officially signed on September the 3rd, was it not?
That's the second.
Second, September the 2nd. But the bombs were dropped in Hiroshima in August.
August 15th, the Empress announced their surrender.
Surrender. Mm. That's right. Now, although the birth was successful, my wife was not physically well, and she had had difficulty lactating. So milk was a great problem. We had anticipated this and bought ourselves what we thought to be a pregnant goat. We even called her Elizabeth. We bought this goat from a couple of Indians. And all we bought was a fat female goat. And she was pregnant, and that she would have baby goat, and then we'd have plenty of milk. But all we bought was a fat female goat, and there was no milk forthcoming from her. But we kept her as a pet. We called her Elizabeth. Now, my wife, though, had very little milk. So we did have, I think, a tin of powdered milk left over, which we were using to supplement this baby with, and I had to cycle to Bahau Town with my friend, Dr. Jaswant Singh Sodhi, to scour the town looking for powdered milk. And this is where, this was the most exciting moment of our stay in Bahau. This is where we, when we were heard of the surrender. But shall we stop in that for that period, and then we'll talk about that later.
Okay,
and we'll talk about other things. What would you want me to talk about now?
Do you know much about the Boys Town, apart from that incident?
Yes. Well, you see, malaria had taken its toll on the physical capabilities of many of the settlers. And the bachelors found it difficult to survive. They could not cultivate the lots that were allocated to them. First of all, they weren't, as I told you, a very industrious lot. Secondly, even though they were industrious, their strength was sapped by malaria and other diseases. So the administration, together with the brothers and the church, decided to set up a boys' town. I mean, you know, boys' town is not new. It is an extension of the international type of boys' town in Bahau, where they would take in all these bachelors, and they would then, as a community, help themselves. They would have a plot of land which they would develop, which they would cultivate, and grow their own food. Now, they had their own quarters, a big hut, and it seemed a very good idea, because they were hopeless individually on their own, and if they were all together, they could help each other as a team. And this is the purpose of setting up Boys Town, and I thought it's a very good idea. But they were not able to produce all the food that they required. They suffered from malnutrition, which compounded their other illnesses. And you know, when they're in groups, they become a little, you know, they plan mischievous things, and I suppose they were desperate and they planned this bit of robbery. But they were, I mean, you know, they were kids. They were not at all criminals. They used to band themselves together and sing, make log fires and sing, do the best. But they would die one after another. Sad. Many of them died.
Why there were so many bachelors? Where were their parents and relatives? I believe they came from Shonan To as well.
Some came in families, and some came on their own, leaving their mothers and fathers and sisters behind. I mean, many of them looked upon it as a form of adventure, as a form of perhaps occupying themselves. In Shonan To, there were no jobs for them. Perhaps here they would be employed in some way or another. They would be able to eke out an existence. So, why there were so many bachelors, I really cannot answer that. But this, I assume, was the situation.
And talking about the living relationships, what do you find the relationships over there?
generally speaking, amicable. We were all friendly with each other. We were all in the same boat. We all suffered the same problems. But there were little pockets of, you know, there were certain personality conflicts among certain individuals. Some, as I said, some thought themselves more superior than the others, and it was nothing more than that. But there were no big fights or no confrontations and so on. The Protestants got on well with the Roman Catholics. The Danes and the other neutrals, they were stuck among, they were stuck in their own group, but they joined our parties. They joined our parties, all right. They're friendly. But you know, there was always this attitude that pervaded, the old colonial attitude, where we all, the people from the pre-war days, used to look at Europeans as though they were a superior race. I mean, this was inborn in us, you know, bred in us. Thing that I resented a lot. And so they were given special treatment.
Why didn't this Europeans intend by the Japanese?
They are neutrals. They belong to neutral countries not involved in the war.
Like
Switzerland,
yes.
Denmark, Sweden. And there were those who were on the side, oh no, why were the Russians there? The white Russians. There were a couple of Russians there. Now, we're talking about